This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first part of the program here, we'll be talking about Africa. And we're very happy to have as our guest Horace Campbell. He's a scholar who has been writing about the politics of Africa and following that for quite a long time. He's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois and will be giving a talk a little bit later today as part of the MillerCom series. His visit here is hosted by the African Studies Center at the university, and we're really pleased that he could be here and spend a little bit of time with us. As a candidate, when he was running for office, his campaign, the Obama campaign, talked about their policy for Africa and said that the administration, if he indeed was elected president, said that his administration would work to integrate Africa into the global economy, that it would work to enhance the security of African states, and also to strengthen relationships with those governments that were committed to deepening democracy and reducing poverty. So one of the things we want to try to do here is to look a little bit at the Africa policy of the Obama administration and make some comparisons between the goals of candidate Obama and the actions of President Obama. We'll talk a little bit about where Africa policy really comes from, and talk about the significance of Barack Obama for people in Africa and other places as well outside of the United States. Let me also mention that our guest, Horace Campbell, will be giving a talk on U.S. foreign policy in Africa this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. This is the W.E.B. Du Bois lecture, and it's particularly appropriate that it's happening today because this is his birthday, the 23rd of February, 1868, the birthday of that great scholar, W.E.B. Du Bois. So as we talk, questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Certainly, we'd be very happy to have questions and comments from folks who are listening. Emails are welcome, too, if people would like to communicate that way. Will-talk@illinois.edu. That is the address. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, I am the one who should give thanks and praises and joy for your work in continuing to reach out to people and educate and to keep public radio and to ensure that the idea of public radio and public good remains in the consciousness of our society.
That's a lovely thought. We should have you here when we're raising money.
Well, it's not about money. It's about the spirit that we should be doing public good. And so on this day, the birthday of Du Bois, I'm here to participate with my colleagues, and I have a wonderful hostess, Professor Mamwe, who's here to have us reflect on how the university can be a space for new thinking about the relationship between the peoples of Illinois, the peoples of the world, and that includes Africa. Yeah. And Barack Obama was a senator from this state. And incidentally, this President Barack Obama shares the burden of another citizen from Illinois, Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And that burden was becoming a president at a moment when the society was in turmoil and the society had to make choices. And Barack Obama is being forced to make choices, extent to which he can make choices that are for the benefit of his two children, his wife, and his family. And for the greater human family, it will be dependent on whether we all see ourselves as part of that family. Mm. If we're not part of a human family, and we're white and we're black, and we are Americans and they're Africans, then we won't be able to resolve any problem, because Barack Obama's mother, she was a woman from Kansas. They call her white as they designate people in the United States. But Barack Obama's mother was a human being who inspired in Barack Obama the idea that his humanity is more important than anything else. And that was what he's brought to the society.
You know, we want to talk about policy. I'm sure we'll talk about policy, but you're already working on the question that I wanted to pose at the beginning and have you talk about the very idea of Barack Obama, the very idea of a black man being president of the United States, and what that means to people. And I initially said, you know, what does that mean to people in Africa? And you're, right away your response was, not just Africa. So maybe then you have to broaden that question and say, for anyone outside of the United States, the very idea of Barack Obama, what does that mean to people?
The idea of Barack Obama meant that the United States has matured, that the United States has gone beyond the moorings of the idea that this is somehow a white nation, as if the United States was ever a white nation, because the United States was a society that built new governmental structures on the territories that were owned by the native people. So people throughout the world followed the campaign of Barack Obama in 2008. And I've written a book about this campaign and what it has meant, Barack Obama and 21st century politics, because Barack Obama was caught in a revolutionary moment, a moment of great expectations. So all over the world, whether people are in Brazil, and you read about the Brazilian woman way up in Bahia, Salvador, these women who were praying and fasting for Barack Obama, not to speak about people in China, who, when I went to China recently, I saw people with the face of Barack Obama on bags and buttons of Barack Obama, to speak of the Caribbean, to speak of Latin America, to speak of Europe. And you remember the reception he had in Germany when he spoke in Germany. And in Africa, Barack Obama could not become a president in his own country, the country where his grandfather comes from. And I do not think Barack Obama should disown Africa, because after all, we're all Africans. You're an African. Africa is the birthplace of humanity. So when we succumb to the ideas of the racist that Barack Obama is an African, we should ask them, where do you come from? Are you from outer space? Because all human beings are from Africa.
What do you think, what do you make of the kind of criticism that has been made of President Obama? And I'm sure we'll hear more of it as we go even further into the presidential campaign, that says that he's some kind of extremely radical individual. People want to question his very Americanism and talk about him having a kind of political orientation that comes out of Africa, or that comes out of the developing world, or you know, they want to place him outside of the American mainstream. I'm not sure that what he's done as president would help you make an argument like that, but that's what his opponents say.
But that's the point. The point is, there's been nothing extreme about Barack Obama. That is precisely the point. The point is that Barack Obama has followed the playbook of defending the Wall Street financial oligarchies. Barack Obama has helped to bail out the banks. Barack Obama has not bailed out homeowners. Barack Obama has not prosecuted BP and the oil companies. Barack Obama has not prosecuted those in MF Global, where people have lost billions of dollars. So the reality is that Barack Obama is trying to play safe to become a second-term president. It is not about Barack Obama. It's about us. Because beneath that talk about Americanism is not subtle. It is very clear. America means white. And therefore, Barack Obama is not white. And no one who is not white should become the president of the United States. For the first time in the history of the United States of America, the president of the United States had to produce his birth certificate. This is extremism. And if we do not see these ideas for what they are, and we give them respectability by debating them, the respectability we need is to see, how do we reconstitute society so that our children can go to schools where they are being taught, where we can have fresh air? Look at the temperature outside in Champaign-Urbana. We are in the middle of global warming. The very same persons who talk about Barack Obama representing some extreme third world version of reality are the same persons who are the ones who deny global warming. They're the same persons who want to take away the rights of women for control over their bodies. They're the same persons who are against same gender loving persons. So we must recognize that the minority in this country, and we have a new formation in this country called the Occupy Movement. They have done the right thing in identifying them as the 1%. So when we say, yes, what do we make of the 1% who say that Barack Obama is not an American? Mm-hmm. So let's identify who they are, because the masses of the 99%, they have other problems. They want health care. They want their children to live in decent communities, and they do not want all the money of the society to be spent on the military and to be deployed in other parts of the world, burning the Quran in Afghanistan in the name of fighting terrorism.
Our guest, let me just introduce again our guest for this hour, is Horace Campbell. He's professor of political science and African American studies at Syracuse University. He's interested in the politics of Africa, the Caribbean, African international relations, Pan-Africanism. He's here visiting the campus to talk about U.S. foreign policy in Africa. He's the author of a number of books, and one that we'll mention if you're interested in reading on this subject is Barack Obama and the 21st Century. Barack Obama and 21st Century Politics, A Revolutionary Moment in the USA, published by Pluto Press in 2010, is out and is available if you'd like to read it. Questions are welcome here, too, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can send us an email as well, will-talk@illinois.edu. So are people then, people who embraced Barack Obama and people who were going around wearing T-shirts with his picture on it around the world, disappointed? Do you think people are disappointed that somehow that there was a promise that they saw, there was a promise there, and do they feel that somehow the promise wasn't fulfilled?
There is a lot of disappointment, and the disappointment is warranted. But the disappointment is being reinforced by those who seek to dominate the airwaves, because among others who are not disappointed, for myself, I'm not disappointed because I understood the reality that he was up against. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama inherited the financial crisis that has been the worst depression since 1933. Barack Obama inherited the overextension of the U.S. armed forces all over the world. He inherited the mess that has been created with the Wall Street financial crisis, inherited unemployment, the bankruptcy of General Motors, inherited the despair that was all over the country. And in the short time, he worked very hard to stabilize this situation and working with other countries throughout the world to return the United States to respectability. He has not done enough. Clearly, the extent to which he can do better is the extent to which we are informed, so that in the universities, our departments of finance no longer teaches that what is good for the financial services industry is good for America, and that greed is good, and the unlimited wealth of the derivatives and Wall Street brokers is good for the country. We need to be able to teach our society that the trillions of dollars that went to bail out Wall Street should go towards reconstruction projects to clean up the environment and create the health and well-being of society. So those who are disappointed are not thinking about the task of this society beyond Barack Obama. He'll be gone after 4 years. And after those 4 years, we will still have global warming. So we still have to start thinking through society and life and health and well-being of the basic needs of human beings.
What about Obama and the administration's policies specifically on Africa and those things that the campaign at least talked about wanting to do, integrate Africa into the global economy, enhance the security of African states, strengthen relationships with those governments that are committed to deepening democracy and reducing poverty. Has the administration done any of that?
Within the limitations of what the U.S. government can do, one of the things it has done quite clearly is to reduce the discussion about terrorism and to wage a global war on terror in Africa. because some of your listeners know that during the Bush administration, there was a fabrication of terrorism in North Africa, to the point that when the revolutions broke out in North Africa, the Libyan leadership, the leadership of Egypt, said, oh, these are Islamic terrorists. Barack Obama says that, oh, we're going to have overseas contingency operations. He was trying to clarify that people or the Islamic faith are not the enemies of Africa. But clearly, the policies that Barack Obama inherited were not made by him. Because policymaking does not come from the presidency. There's a whole institutional framework within think tanks, corporations, foundations that informs the policymaking environment. And what we have to do at this time is how do we make these ideas about promoting democratic participation in Africa more meaningful. And let us take an example like Libya. The people of Libya wanted to have democratic participation. Instead, NATO intervened. NATO militarized the situation in a civil war, carried out regime change, executed the president of the country, and postponed democracy. So the extent to which the Barack Obama administration is continuing the policies of the U.S. Africa Command can be checked by us. We must say that Africa does not want a U.S. military command. Africa wants engagement with communities to restore the health of the communities. They want to have environmental cleanup in Africa. They want decent education in Africa. And the military cannot provide that. And because the military management of the world economy is the main instrument of U.S. foreign policy, Barack Obama is caught into that policy environment. And if you followed the Libyan engagement very carefully, you would recall that Obama himself was against the deployment of U.S. troops. And I can say that the top echelons of the Pentagon were also opposed to it because the Pentagon understands that they're overstretched. The extent to which we in the peace movement, we in the public radio, raise our voices against militarization, then Obama can have room for leverage. Let me give one clear example. Mm-hmm. Today, we have in the Middle East and North Africa, a big call for a war against Iran. Why do we have this call for war against Iran? Why would the United States want to be dragged into a war against Iran? If Iran is developing nuclear weapons, let us work within the confines of the United Nations, the International Atomic Agency, and the international community to denuclearize Iran, just as we should denuclearize Israel. So why would some people want to have a hue and cry about Iran? And so we have seen that the Barack Obama administration is buffeted on very different sides from people who want a continuation of the militaristic policies of the government of the United States. It is up to decent citizens of the United States of America to say those are wrong priorities. We have priorities about reconstruction out of this depression and relations with China, Brazil, India, Russia to stabilize the world economy so that the Greek crisis, the economic crisis in Europe, does not take the world into the spiral of depression, competitive devaluations, and those things in the 1930s that took us to war.
Yeah. Coming back to Libya for a moment, since you talked about your feeling that the military involvement that took place was not the thing to do, what do we do about Syria then?
What do we do about Syria? We need to work very hard and exhaust all diplomatic options within the structures of the United Nations and working with those sections of the Middle East, not the dictators that are in Saudi Arabia. I'm amused when people talk about Syria, but they never talk about Saudi Arabia. We work with the countries of the world, China, Russia, India, and we work very hard at the diplomatic level so that we can have Assad step down. It is not in the interest of the world that we have another war in the Middle East, because that war will spiral out of control to bring in Iran, Pakistan, and the next thing you know that India will be involved in a war with Pakistan, and you would never know where this will end. So those who are calling for military intervention do not understand the complexities of the social, cultural, and ethnic mix inside of Syria. And that level of ignorance can lead us into great dangers.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Horace Campbell. He's professor of political science and African American studies at Syracuse University. He's here to talk about U.S. foreign policy in Africa, visiting the campus as visit sponsored by the Center for African Studies. He'll be speaking at 4 o'clock this afternoon on the campus in the Knight Auditorium of Spurlock Museum. And questions here as we talk about some of these same subjects are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email also will-talk@illinois.edu. Another thing that I'm very interested in having you talk about is what has been going on now over the last about year or so in places like Tunisia and Egypt, elsewhere in the Arab world, these events that for shorthand have come to be called the Arab Spring, that really began with Tunisia and with Egypt. And I know in talking about this that you really want to place that in an African context, or at least you want to remind people where Tunisia and Egypt are. How do you see that as being something that is connected with Africa, and that's something that people should remember?
Well, one of the limitations of the media is that the media jumps on bandwagons, and people who are ignorant about the geography of the world try to take Egypt out of Africa. And there's a long historical reason for this, because if Egypt was a cradle of human civilization and you take Egypt out of Africa, then you're able to remove the great contributions of Africa to human transformations. The young people of Tunisia who sacrificed themselves to remove dictators in Egypt and Tunisia, these young people are part of the billions of youth who are unemployed, billions of young people throughout the world who want a better future. Mohamed Bouazizi in Tunisia, and Tunisia is part of an old African capital that used to be called Carthage. And these young people in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, were standing up for change. And when one speaks about the Arab world, the largest population in this so-called Arab world is the 86 million Egyptians. And Egypt have a direct link on the Nile River. So we call it the Nile Revolution. And this Nile Revolution is part of what is going on in Senegal. And we have a recent book about this called The African Awakenings, Emerging Revolutions. And in this book, published by Pambazuka, it spells out quite clearly why this storm is taking place. Because after 30 years of the structural adjustment of the policies of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, the African young people are tired of unemployment, are tired of exploitation. They're tired of people of Mike Mubarak having $70 billion and people are unemployed. And this is not just an Egyptian problem, because we saw the people in Wisconsin learning from Egypt. We saw the people in Greece and Spain. It is a worldwide problem. One of the positive aspects about the Egyptian process is how women came in the forefront of the leadership, how they attempt to transcend religious differences. And those who want to keep the banks, the insurance companies, and the oil companies in control will try to promote religious differences. That's why they talk about Islam and a war against Islam. But our job, those of us who want decency and peace, we want to see a transformation of these economies in North Africa, because they're not by any means poor countries. How to transform their economies so that the majority of people have the basic well-being to have a better society.
Yeah, I certainly think that it is true. We've talked about it some on this program, and I certainly think that it's true that people who have followed politics in Egypt and Tunisia, perhaps other places as well, would say that these revolutions, they didn't just happen. They didn't come out of nowhere. That there was a decades-long political struggle going on that perhaps in the West didn't get a lot of attention.
Exactly.
People who spoke out on issues around democracy and good governments, people who challenged their own governments and often suffered greatly for it. That the revolutions that we've seen now, particularly carried out by young people, they are standing on the shoulders of people who came before them, maybe people whose names will never even be known. So having said all that, you know, you can't really say that these revolutions just came out of nowhere. But I am interested in having you talk about how perhaps people in other places, in Africa and other places, are indeed looking to what has happened in Egypt and in Tunisia and perhaps some other places as well, as providing some either models or inspiration or both for political change in their own countries.
Clearly. And that is the lessons of the past 30 years. Mm-hmm. In fact, if we remember, and I think you may be old enough to remember, that in South Africa, the movement against racism, the movement against apartheid, was not against white people. It was a movement against barbarism. Mm-hmm. And it inspired people throughout the world. So Nelson Mandela lived up to this tradition, and Mandela came forward and presented a new spirit of reconciliation called Ubuntu. He didn't say, oh, well, they killed our people, so we're going to have revenge. He said, no, we want forgiveness, we want reconciliation, and we want peace. And that tradition from the South African transformation inspired the people of Egypt. As you rightly said, the people of Egypt didn't come out of anywhere. What was different and new was the leadership of young people and how they mobilized social media and new networks of networks. So workers, women, youth, and different people came together to be able to bring popular power in the streets. And Tahrir Square has changed the history of revolutions. Because no more will we think of revolutions as in the 20th century of armed struggle. Tahrir Square has brought a new revolutionary possibility, and everywhere people are studying what kind of mechanisms develop. And our university students are studying this, because our university students do not want to go to school and end up with big debts, and then they do not have jobs. So in Wisconsin, when the governor of Wisconsin said that he wanted to take away the collective bargaining rights of workers, when in Virginia they want to carry out what is really barbaric procedures on women, we are seeing that the ruling elements today do not respect the dignity of human beings. And that is what the people of Egypt and Tunisia were fighting for. And dignity cannot come overnight. It comes from long-term organizing and new political formations.
We are talking in this hour of Focus with Horace Campbell. He's professor of political science at African American Studies at Syracuse University. He's here to talk about foreign policy in Africa in a talk this afternoon on the campus. We will talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics for you every week. In the second hour today, we'll be talking about the Illinois state budget, and we'll have two guests with us, economist Fred Gertz and political scientist Bob Rich. They're both affiliated with the U of I Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Yesterday in Springfield, Illinois Governor Pat Quinn presented his plan for the budget, for the state's budget for the fiscal year that will begin in July. high, and there are some very big problems that the state has to confront. The two big ones are Medicaid and pensions, and the governor really didn't say very much about how he would deal with those two things. But we'll talk with our guests about generally about the conditions of the state, financial condition of the state, and some of the state's big problems. Then let me also just mention that tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock program, we'll be talking with Wade Davis. He's explorer in residence for the National Geographic Society. He's an anthropologist. He's an ethnobotanist. And he is the author of a new book that we'll be talking about that's titled Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory and the Conquest of Everest. And this tells the story of George Mallory. He was a British mountain climber. Perhaps the greatest mountain climber of his time, and it's the story of his attempt to climb Mount Everest. This was in the early 1920s, something took his life. More on that tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. You can get the schedule by going to the website, which is will.illinois.edu. You can follow us on Twitter, Will Public Media. You can also find us on Facebook. In this hour of focus, our guest is Horace Campbell. He's professor of political science and African American studies at Syracuse University. His specialties include the politics of Africa and the Caribbean, African international relations, Pan-Africanism. He's the author of the book Barack Obama and 21st Century Politics, A Revolutionary Moment in the USA, published in 2010. And he'll be giving a talk on U.S. foreign policy in Africa on the U of I campus this afternoon at 4 at the Knight Auditorium and the Spurlock Museum. His host for his visit here to the university is the Center for African Studies. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for a moment, I want to go back to something that you said, and I wonder whether you I was going to say whether you really believe. I'm sure you do because you said it. But I just found it really stunning, and if it's true, hopeful, that indeed more people in more places would start thinking differently about what a revolution is, mm-hmm. and how and what are the tools that you have to employ, mm-hmm. and the possibility that people would move away from violence mm-hmm. as the chief mm-hmm. method mm-hmm. And move in more and more into nonviolent political action. You really think we may have turned something of a corner there?
Every day we see new manifestations of this. I was watching the television on Monday night where I saw the woman of Virginia. And the woman of Virginia had a silent, nonverbal protest against the governor for their rights. We have seen this in Wisconsin, where the police and firefighters came out to protect public workers who were and are still fighting to preserve the basic democratic rights of collective bargaining. We've seen this in Tunisia, and we've seen this in Egypt. This is something that they studied. They studied how to have a nonviolent revolution. They went to Serbia. They studied Martin Luther King. They studied Gandhi. So it did not come overnight. The way that they brought on Mubarak was a studied political strategy to ensure that the military does not provoke greater violence so that Christians and Muslims would kill each other. This is a new revolutionary moment, and this revolutionary moment will work itself out in the next 8 to 9 years. Mm-hmm. And in this period, we will see, as we are seeing in Greece today, whether the working people of Greece can decide whether the health, the well-being, the pensions of the people of Greece are more important than the bankers and the speculators. The European Central Bank, the European Union, they are more concerned about the speculators on Wall Street than the people of the Greece. That was the case in Egypt. Mubarak and his cronies, they were making billions of dollars. They were supposed to have had $70 billion. The policy of the IMF and the World Bank was to strengthen those forces. Whether it is in Illinois, whether it is the federal government, the question is not about economics and budgets. The question is of political power. who are the forces that make decisions about where government spends its money.
Now, as you say, I think rightly, and a lot of people would say that this story that we've seen in Egypt is just opening up. So we really don't know how the story will play out.
But it is our job to study it,
yeah,
and to tell more people about it, because they didn't come to it overnight. They studied Martin Luther King.
Hmm. I'm thinking about the government, Mr. Mubarak, and people close to him were making money off of the way things were. Well, people in the military were also very invested in the country's economy. And I think some people would argue that really what happened was there that the military cut Mr. Mubarak loose because they saw their interests were threatened. So the question is, as this story continues to play out, what really will happen? And do we go beyond the point where some people would argue what we see now essentially is a military coup, because the military is still running the country? So will that really move towards something really like a representative democracy and not more, just more of the same?
Well, those who believe it's a military coup, it's a disrespect for the kind of work that went into removing Mubarak. Mm. That's the first point. The second point is that the conditions that created the space for the mobilization of the people of Egypt, they have not gone away. Unemployment has not been solved. People are still poor. The farmers are still poor. The workers still want right. The workers want better pay. They want better sanitation. They want better education. Those cannot be solved by removing Mubarak. And so the revolution is still in its embryonic stages. Mm-hmm. And so those who expect things to change overnight, they have no understanding of what it means to put a revolution in movement.
I want to raise a question here, at least bring in the thoughts of someone who writes in on an email. And I think the person here makes some excellent points, and maybe as a reflection of the way I've been talking, not so much I think the way that you've been talking, but the way I've been talking. And the person writes this, it's that, I'd like to say that it's a bit of a misnomer to refer to the African view or African politics, much as it would be to refer to the North American view or North American politics. Pan-Africa does not exist at this time, and to use the term Africa to refer to all nations on that continent does a huge disservice to the variety of economic and political states throughout it. Because of that, the person writes, I think it would benefit the world to begin to see the individual countries, their unique concerns, strengths, benefits, and so forth, as they are, rather than continuing to combine them as a single entity. Kenya, for example, should be held up as a positive example for developing nations, but especially in Africa. Somalia, on the other hand, should be held up as an example of a counterexample, what you should not do. So the question is ultimately, how is it that members of the world community can help support the positive work and condemn the individual conflicts and concerns when the world continues to treat them all as one?
Well, see, the idea of Africa is a political question. Mm. Because Africa was partitioned, it was plundered, and the peoples of Africa have a consciousness of themselves as African. And the Pan-Africanism arose from this. And one of the immediate goals of the African peoples, the immediate goal is to remove the borders of Africa. Mm. My hostess, who brought me here, she is from Senegal. Part of her family is in Mauritania. There's no border. The border goes between the Pula nation of Mauritania and Senegal. All over Africa, we have these borders that were established at the Berlin Conference by leaders who did not know where the people came from. So the Maasai in Kenya are divided. The Somali are divided into five different countries, and there was a great Somali nation. There will be no peace in Africa until there's unity of the peoples of Africa. And that is the goal of the African Union. That is the goal of the Pan-African movement. Mm-hmm. I respect the writings of this person who sent in the email, because that person is correct. In Kenya, when the people are struggling for democracy against a government that manipulates the people and kills people. We need judicial processes in Kenya that can bring such persons before course of justice. When Robert Mugabe does wrong in Zimbabwe, we need the institutions within Zimbabwe to hold them accountable. And in Nigeria, the Nigerian ruling elements squander the wealth and divide the people. We need to hold them accountable. We cannot wait until Africa is united to say that the Nigerian robber barons should not be sending billions of dollars outside. But we who live and work in universities here, we should be studying the capital flight from Africa, the $940 billion that has been plundered out of Africa. Instead of talking about development and aid, we should be talking about how do we return those funds to Africa.
Yeah. I'd like to hear you talk some more about the Pan-African project, Pan-African idea, and where that stands now. I know that there are people that are still dedicated to it, and in fact are saying that it's something that we needs to continue to be refreshed and reassessed and say, you know, perhaps it needs to change a little bit, but that it's as important now to think about that, think about Africa in that way as it has been. What is the status of Pan-Africanism now?
It is most healthy, and it is guided by new principles. 40 years ago, it was against colonialism. Then, 20 years ago, it was against apartheid. But having won those victories, and those victories were not won lightly, we paid very high price for it. The killing of Patrice Lumumba, the overthrow of Kwame Nkrumah, the killing of Amilcar Cabral. But with a new leadership and a new spirit of peace from Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu, with the ideas of Ubuntu, the Pan-African project is now stronger and healthier. Let me give you four elements of the project. Mm-hmm. The first element, freedom of movement of the peoples across Africa so that they can have democratic right to breathe and to move freely. That project is inscribed in the African Union, and we have an agenda and timetable for the full unity of Africa. Second project, to have the kind of infrastructure across Africa to open up Africa to transform the African economies. Third project, one of the great Pan-African leaders that just passed last year was Wangari Maathai from Kenya. She was an environmentalist. And on the table we have the Great Green Wall of Africa. The Great Green Wall of Africa is to build a wall of 7,000 kilometers across North Africa to stop the desert. And the project is how do we repair the environment in Africa? And we have projects of unity. So across Africa, the Pan-African Project has gone beyond the statements of leaders like Mugabe or Abdoulaye Wade. They are about reconstructing the health and life and well-being of the people. And the African women are at the forefront of this Pan-African Project because it's about life and health and peace in the 21st century.
We're coming down to about our last 5-6 minutes. Our guest for this hour is Horace Campbell. He's professor of political science and African-American studies at Syracuse University here on the campus to talk about U.S. foreign policy in Africa. We do have a caller, and we would try to get in as many as we can in the time that remains. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here is someone in Savoy to talk with. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. Well, I'll skip the three or four that I wanted to ask and just get down to one. I'm concerned about the large sums of money that apparently the guest agrees are leaving Africa and going out by the so-called leaders of Africa and not having any relationship or benefit to the majority of the people in Africa, and that's what I figure is happening to most American aid. I wondered if the guest knew any ways in which to see to it that these people don't cream off most of it for themselves and trickle down a little bit to everybody else.
Yes, thank you so much. There is a United Nations initiative about returning stolen assets. And unfortunately, the universities do not teach about these initiatives of the United Nations. For example, if you take a country such as Equatorial Guinea, we can name the bank in Virginia where this money is located. And the son had large properties in California. Our universities, instead of working with private military corporations that are protecting that dictator, we should be publicizing the amount of wealth that is being stolen. Look at this man from Nigeria, this banker whose son was arrested for trying to blow up a plane. He lived in a $2 million apartment in London. So the elites in Africa who are stealing the money, they are doing it in consultation and collaboration with financial institutions, the big banks and a financial industry that are plundering the wealth of Africa.
Well, thank you. Is there anything more direct and specific that can happen? Because what you're describing might get some of the wealth back, and it might just go out in the hands of some of the other people who are now taking their turn at doing this. Is there anything more direct that can happen so that either it goes in this better way or we just don't give them the money?
You're not giving them the money. I think you should rethink that. The money is actually coming out of Africa. One thing we should do, we should get away from the idea that the United States should have a military force in Africa. Most of the military forces in Africa are supporting African governments that use these military forces to keep themselves in power. That's what Mubarak did in Egypt. That's what Ben Ali did in Tunisia. That's what Gaddafi was attempting to do. And if you look at the case of Gaddafi, Gaddafi's $150 billion is still held by Western countries. So Africa is a very, very, very rich continent. What we need in Africa are accountable leaders. We need the democratic movement in Wisconsin and Egypt to continue so that we elect governments in Kenya, governments in Senegal that are democratic, that can respond to the will and needs of the people.
Well, I agree with that. That sounds very good, but I'm a little more concerned about the immediate impacts. I'm going to have to ignore temporarily at least the fact that there are different layers of people and each are having their good time proposing their ideas, and some of them are getting kickbacks and some of them are getting money. I wish to ignore that for the time being and say, well, what has to happen more rapidly to get... I mean, you know, you mentioned Northern Africa, but the same thing is happening in the blackest Africa. These people are killing one another and blowing the money and creaming the money off, and nothing seems to be progressing.
Well, if you look at what's going on today in Senegal, the Senegalese people are saying to Abdoulaye Wade that we do not want you. The people are saying to Senegal that Abdoulaye Wade, who gave a present of $200,000 to an IMF official, we do not want this kind of fraud. And the people today are in the streets. We want citizens in the United States to raise their voices to support the democratic project in Senegal. That is not something in the future. We need that IMF official to return the $200,000 to the people of Senegal.
Hmm. We're here to the point where we have about a minute or so left. There is much more that we could discuss. Maybe I can just give you the opportunity to give some thoughts, or you know, what are the thoughts that you would like to leave with folks?
The thought I would like to leave is the kind of work we do. The University of Illinois is a great university. I have just come back from teaching for one semester at Tsinghua University, which is the number one university in China. Mm-hmm. Tsinghua University, it was conceived and built with the assistance of the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. It is now one of the leading science and technology university. We need to extend that historical record of the University of Illinois Champaign. How we can have a world of cooperation and peace. How can we unleash the engineering to reverse global warming so that our students are doing research on the Great Green Wall? Our students are doing research on solar production so that we can electrify Africa. How can we move from the old forms of thinking of white supremacy and giving aid to Africa to a new solidarity between human beings? That is the work we have to do in the 21st century.
Well, at that, I think we're going to have to finish with, the mention that our guest for this part of the show, Horace Campbell, will be giving a talk on the campus this afternoon. At 4 o'clock, he'll be talking about U.S. foreign policy in Africa. The question, is Obama policy a continuation or a break? That's this afternoon at 4, taking place in the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. This is an event in the MillerCom series. These events are always open and to the public and free. So if you're interested in hearing more from him, you certainly should stop by. His visit here is sponsored by the Center for African Studies at the University of Illinois. And again, if you'd like to read some of his writing, you might look at his most recent book, which is Barack Obama and 21st Century Politics, A Revolutionary Moment in the USA. That book published by Pluto Press, and it came out in 2010. Our guest, Horace Campbell, is professor of political science, African-American studies at Syracuse University. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.